Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 6th of August. This hour, we continue the conversation about the horrendous shooting at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, which took place yesterday. There is going to be a press conference starting soon, which we are monitoring, and we'll let you know what details emerge as a result of this. Press conference, the whole event, I think, is deeply unnerving and troubling to everybody. The shooter now has been identified as Wade Michael Page, who is evidently leader of a racist white power band that's known as End Apathy. One of our guests this hour, professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, has been watching developments all day yesterday and today, and will know more about this group and who this shooter is. And we will be talking with him. The other thing that was happening, and I've mentioned this in the first hour, it was so remarkable. First of all, the horrors of this taking place at the worship services of the members of the Sikh temple in Oak Creek. And to a person, everybody who was commenting, who was a member of the temple, it was extraordinary, I thought, yesterday. Absolutely extraordinary. They were peaceful. They were attempting to explain what their faith is all about, because many people don't know about the Sikh faith, and they were calm in the midst of all of this horror. I was so struck by that. We're going to be speaking with Tom Heinen, who is director of the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee. There is a Sikh member of that organization, actually, who will join us tomorrow during our 9 o'clock hour so we can learn more about the Sikh faith. There were vigils that were taking place, and, of course, the faith community, everybody is shaken by this, but we'll have Tom will have response from the faith community. And, of course, we'll give you now this hour a chance to talk about all that happened yesterday. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and you can also leave messages on our Facebook page. We start our conversation. Chuck Kornbach will be joining us after the press conference takes place as well. Tom Heinen, director of the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee, hello.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Tom. You must have had the same response I did. I watched an awful lot of the coverage yesterday, and it was so amazing to me to listen to the people who were members of that Sikh temple. There was a calmness, there was a graciousness about each and every person that I found just extraordinary.
It really is, and there is that sense of graciousness. If you're interviewing Swanji Arora tomorrow,
yes, we are.
He exemplifies that. Just the most gracious, pleasant man that you could possibly hope to meet. And an example of a person who lives his faith and who is just a delight and a pleasure to be with.
Yes. What is the response been? I know there were vigils in Milwaukee and in Madison. People wonder, what in the world can I do after an event like this? And a lot of people just wanted to gather and dig within their own faith to find something.
You know, it's true. At a time like that, people do just have a need to gather. There were some spontaneous gatherings, I think, such as the one in Cathedral Square Park, which may have been driven partly by social networking. There was a one of the members of our board, Reverend Seth Dietrich, the rector of Christ Church Episcopal in Whitefish Bay, held a service inviting people of all faiths to come there last night. I know the Lutheran bishop was intending to be there. I was still here at the office working on other matters related to this at the time that began. And so there is that desire to help. We've been in touch with Swanji, who in turn is networking with the Sikh community here, the communities, to see what we can do and others can do that we can direct them in terms of help. So we've asked him we've had requests for people wanting to donate money. We've had requests from some representatives of faiths and agencies wanting to provide counseling and other services, and we've conveyed that to him. I spoke with him this morning. He was still weary and fatigued, having been in Oak Creek until late last night. And the one message that he wanted to deliver now, and I'm sure he'll do it even much, much better tomorrow, is just extreme gratitude in a very gracious way for the outpouring of support and condolences, mm-hmm. just dozens and dozens of email messages and of phone messages that he and others have received.
So much an example of a peacefulness and an acceptance that we should be emulating. I guess that's what was striking about this to me. And juxtapose that with the horror and the hate of this kind of crime. It's hard to take it all in. You know, it was something that made you just pause, and you could understand their great tragedy, but also get a bit of an understanding about who the people are. Have there been a lot of threats against the Sikh community in southeastern Wisconsin that you're aware of, Tom, or is this a real aberration?
We haven't been aware of threats, and I raised that topic in my conversation this morning. Certainly, when the hostages were taken in Iran some decades ago, American hostages, and then after 9/11, there have been isolated incidents. Nothing as violent here as perhaps in other parts of the country where Sikhs were attacked and in at least one case killed, having been mistaken for Muslims. Not that it would have been any better,
right.
Obviously. But I asked him about that, and he says it's kind of the unknown entity. There certainly is some confusion, and they do kind of represent the other to some people, a manifestation of foreignness. Partly because the men who are observant would wear turbans. So when there's a gas station operator who's robbed or a cab driver who's beaten, they don't really always know what the underlying reasons would be. But in general, and I asked them this specifically, you know, they haven't had a pattern of hate and discrimination and threats in any way that's discernible to them. Whether that's true in other parts of the country, I don't know. I mean, there have been maybe more incidents in some other parts of the country.
Mm-hmm. And what would you want, as the director of the Interfaith Conference, what would you want the investigation to focus on? Do we need to know a whole lot more about this guy who committed these horrendous acts, this neo-Nazi? Do we need to understand those groups and how prevalent they are right now? Do we need to understand the Sikh faith more? Do we need gun control legislation? What do we need?
You know, I've thought about that a lot, and I think there are parallel courses to take. At one level, the hate groups have been on the rise. The Southern Poverty Law Center, in their annual intelligence report, has shown a tremendous growth among hate groups. Many of them directed against other groups for religious and racial reasons. Now, there's quite a growth of them. They still are on the fringe and very much a minority, but I really think it's a group. Those are groups that where they need to be addressed. And through the internet and websites, who knows how they can reach out to people and who they're reaching out to among our young. So it sends the message that we need to be vigilant and we need to do better education of our own young people. But it also, the incident taps, I think, a strain within American society where there is a lack of knowledge of other faiths. There was a book called Religious Literacy published not too long ago, and certainly confirmed by Pew Forum reports, where in the United States, people practice their faiths ardently, but they know very little even about their own faiths, let alone other faiths. Such to the extent that something like 10% of the population thinks that Joan of Arc was Noah's wife, even with her own biblical literacy and illiteracy here.
Oh, my gosh.
So, I mean, I use that as kind of the quintessential example. It always gets a laugh and gets attention, but it goes deeper than that. And even among evangelicals, there isn't as much knowledge of the Bible as one would think. So in a country, and certainly in the Milwaukee area, that has become one of the most religiously diverse societies in the world, there's a real need for us to understand each other better and a lack of knowledge there. So I think it's been a call to us, and we've been working on that, to do a better job of outreach, to go beyond the so-called choir of people who already have an interest in this with programs. We've done some pilot Amazing Faith dinners where you get 8 to 10 people in a private home, all of as many as possible of a different faith. You can only know one other person. You break bread at a simple meal, and then you answer questions, go around the table. No one can interrupt you. And it's not what does the Catholic Church teach about salvation, you know, or name three Hindu gods or goddesses. It's really how you live your faith. What's your experience of forgiveness and what you've been taught and what you've really lived? And, you know, some traditions believe that there's a higher power who has a plan for you. Do you think so? And if so, what is that plan? And it's an amazing experience. We had Swarnji Arora at my home along with people of other faiths, and we've done a number of pilot dinners like this. And at the end of the evening, after this type of sharing, it moderated, but then some free discussion, I've had people tell me they know people around that table better than they know their own neighbors.
Oh,
and so it's a telling comment just on everyday life in general. You don't get to that depth when you're, you know, cutting your grass and waving to your neighbor. But it's much more important, I think, on these faith-driven matters. We are diverse. It's getting more diverse, and we really need to understand each other better. On the positive side, there was a new book that came out last year, American Grace, that says we are a remarkably tolerant nation and very accepting of other faiths, and that there's a high percentage of people, even of some fundamentalist, more fundamentalist religions, that believe that others will be saved and can be saved from a Christian perspective. And it's more on the fringes where you have growing groups that feel they're misunderstood, that don't understand what's going on and are reacting violently. So I think the challenge is for us to get to know each other better and realize what we have in common. And it's really, you know, people taken aback by the graciousness and the lack of vindictiveness of the Sikh people who've been interviewed. It's not really a surprise to those of us who know them, even a few of them. And it's a great opportunity. Unfortunately, we can take tragedy and turn it to a better purpose. So I think it is an opportunity for us all to realize there's a lot that we have in common and a lot to work toward to make life better for all of us.
Well spoken. Let's go to some phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Tom Heinen, director of the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee, is our guest this part of the program. Later on, we'll be speaking with the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University. And sometime during this hour, Chuck Kornbach will be joining us. He is our Wisconsin Public Radio reporter at the scene at the press conference, which should be taking place relatively soon at the Oak Creek Police Department. Rick in Milwaukee is our first caller for you, Tom. Hi, Rick.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to make two basic points, if I can. I was out on Sunday afternoon and bumped into a young man, a very handsome young fellow, kind of tall and lean. And he told me that he was a Sikh, and he was from, he called it a church there in Oak Creek instead of a temple. And so I went and reached out my hand to him, and I held his hand for a moment. And you know, I tried to tell him I didn't think this was any kind of general American attitude toward the Sikh religion or culture, but that I said, I'm sure this will turn out to be some kind of a nutcase that did this. Anyway, we had a very charming talk, and if he can hear me out there, Jay, I hope you're doing better. I'll have to talk to you again in the future.
Thank you very much, Rick, for the call. What about, and we're going to spend some time on this Wade Michael Page and this hate group he evidently was a member of. What about our understanding of those groups? You talked, Tom, about how hate groups are on the rise. What do we do about that?
I think we have to be proactive and preemptive in the sense that we have to find a way to reach out beyond our comfortable social circles where people tend to all think alike, which is another facet of American life, the big sort. We tend to gather in groups of like-minded people. I think we have to break out of that and reach out and have conversations and get to know others. The those fringe groups, I mean, Wisconsin does have a history of they certainly exist here and have over the last few decades. I'm not sure how you approach them other than to be vigilant. When the neo-Nazis came to West Allis last year to demonstrate in response to incidents at State Fair Park, there were certainly counter-demonstrators there, but there were also, I mean, we issued statements. We let it be known that this isn't acceptable to the religious leaders in this community, and that the collective moral conscience and that voice can and will speak out against it. It's a fascinating question, because I think, you know, I don't know that we're going to invite neo-Nazi bands or right separatist bands to come and perform in an interfaith event in the hopes that we can reach them.
Right.
At that stage, I don't know. But I would say that it's like faith itself, it's a journey. We're looking for ways to be more effective in having a positive impact on society. And so I'd welcome ideas on how what can be done. We certainly would like to know if there are any groups that are making inroads that seem to have an active presence in some way through flyers, through the Internet in Wisconsin. So they could certainly call that to our attention. And we could, you know, network with other organizations, some of which might be more directed at that issue, and see what we can, you know, what we can do. But it is a great question, and it's one that I think about, is the tilts of society in certain directions and where are we headed. So that's why I just think it's so important to keep those issues alive and to have people have real experiences. I mean, I'll tell you, if you did a poll in Milwaukee, I mean, it's not just religion, it's also race and then culture. And those dinners that I talked about that we may do on a larger scale bring people of different cultures and races and faiths together. It's under the rubric of faith, but if you get a Black Pentecostal sitting across the table from a Lutheran from Western Waukesha County or a Catholic, and they're sharing their lives, or a Hispanic immigrant there, you're seeing them as real people, and you're getting past the stereotypes.
Yeah, it's a wonderful idea. Tom Heinen is with us, director of the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee. The press conference is underway. And here's what we're learning from the press conference. Police are confident there was only one shooter in spite of initial reports. The Oak Creek Police Chief John Edwards said that the police ordered the shooter to drop his weapons. The shooter opened fire, and the police returned fire, killing the suspect. The officer who was shot is listed in critical condition, Lieutenant Brian Murphy, who's a 51-year-old officer. He's a former tactical team leader. And the victims include a 41-year-old male, a 49-year-old male, a 62-year-old male, a 39-year-old male, a 41-year-old female, and an 84-year-old male. Also, two wounded people are in critical condition. One more has been treated and released from the hospital. So that's the latest from the press conference. More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tom Heinen with us the first half of this hour. Tom in Fort Atkinson is our next caller. Hi, Tom.
Hey, good morning, Kathleen. I'd just like to get your opinion and your guest, Tom's opinion, on something I want to just throw out here. I don't know if you saw it or if anybody else out there listening saw. I think it was about 2 weeks ago in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, right after the Colorado shooting, they did a listing, a chronology of all the shootings that occurred in this country over the last 40 years, and the one that just really jumped out at me was August of 1966, the clock tower shooting down in Texas. And I think that one was for me at least, the loss of innocence. We were just shocked then and appalled how anything like that could happen. Somebody could just shoot down innocent people. And then you look at all the shootings we've had since then, and you just know there's going to be another shooting. There will be another shooting and another until we can really wrap our arms around the true meaning, I think, of the Second Amendment. And all these discussions that I listen to about this, everybody talks around it, but nobody really, I think, addresses the issue. The Second Amendment, and I'm just sort of doing this off the top of my head right now, but it says that a well-regulated militia, being necessary for the security of a free state, the people shall have the right to keep and bear arms. And it's very close to that. But the point that people are making is that it is in order to maintain a well-regulated militia. That's why we have the right to keep and bear arms. But the fact is, we don't have a militia in this country anymore. We've got the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, the CIA, and on and on and on. And so my whole question, I guess, is do we, in fact, have the right to keep and bear arms? I think it should be well regulated, as the amendment says. Nobody's suggesting that we're going to take hunting rifles away from people. But I think these semi-automatic killing machines have got to be regulated, if not controlled or banned.
Thank you, Tom, for the call. Tom.
The Interfaith Conference, which is 42 years old, has consistently advocated for forms of gun control and has consistently spoken out against violence, especially firearms violence. We were opposed to concealed carry. I don't know, you know, realistically, are we going to get guns removed from the American landscape, and which guns? Those are related issues. There hasn't been great success in recent years. I look at it this way, is that, and it was with the concealed carry issue especially, it's an embracement of violence as a solution to society's problems. And when we pass concealed carry at a time when crime rates were ostensibly dropping. But is violence the solution, and are you prepared to take a person's life for certain protection of property? I think that's pretty critical. When I was a reporter for the Journal Sentinel, they sent me to take a gun class that was being offered on how to shoot to kill.
Really?
So I didn't tell them I was a reporter, and we were in the basement of a gun shop on National Avenue, and they're teaching you, you know, here's how you do it, and a variety of weapons. But the fundamental lesson that was taught, it was an accurate story that I wrote, and the person teaching the course was a big gun advocate and one of the leading educators and proponents of it here, and he thought it was a fair story. But the reality of it was, with a handgun, it's very inaccurate, and so you can't shoot to wound. If you pull that gun out, you're committing yourself to take someone down, to kill them, and you aim at the torso. And so so it's more than I want a gun to protect myself. I think you have to carry that thinking another step. Are you prepared to take a life because you've heard a noise or whatever? Mm. So that's just one level. But I think on a religious, philosophical level, I mean, I think a society that sees violence increasingly as a solution to violence is something that, you know, there's a need for religious leaders to speak out. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say every single gun should be banned, but where is the wisdom in the middle ground there?
Randy in Key Wascom, hi.
Thank you for taking my call. First and foremost, my prayers go out to the people at the Sikh temple. That being said, it bothers me that basically it started out with Kathleen and all your guests just becoming an attack on the Second Amendment. Basically, this person should not have had a firearm because he had a less than honorable discharge from the military. He's been on the Southern Poverty Law Center's watch list since 2000, which means he was probably on government lists. So to take this and use it against the Second Amendment, now there too you had a caller that talked about well-regulated militia. Well, you have to look at the vernacular of the time. At the time, well-regulated meant disciplined or well-trained. And militia was a local group. When you're talking about the State National Guard, that is a select militia, which is basically, by the Founding Fathers, was considered the same thing as a standing army. And the Founding Fathers were very worried about an overpowerful government using the army against its people to impose its rule. And that's the main reason for the Second Amendment, not hunting.
All right. I need to hold you there, not because I disagree with what you're saying, Randy, but we're running short on time and we have another guest. Tom.
We may
do an interfaith prayer service. We're communicating with the Sikh community, and so that could be on the horizon within a day or two, but we want it to be something that's meaningful to them, not necessarily just to us. We have interfaith youth cafes where we do, in conjunction with the Archdiocese of Milwaukee and Cardinal Stritch, we bring youths together of different faiths. I think there are a lot of things that are happening and can happen beyond that to help bring healing and enlightenment, and anything we can do, we're happy to.
Mm-hmm. And have you heard from the Sikh community at Oak Creek or in Brookfield, for that matter, of any help that they need?
I've put that message out there. It was difficult for us to reach them yesterday.
Yes, I imagine.
And we wanted to also respect Swaranji, our representative, on who has been a great asset to us over the years. So he's, at least for now, is the intermediary, and we're going to make some direct contact later today and see what would best suit their needs. There may be information we can put up on our website later today, www.interfaithconference.org, if we decide that it would help them for us to become a conduit for donations or to do other things. Right now, we want to respect them with the same graciousness that they're reacting to this horrific tragedy and do what's in their best interests. So we're moving in that direction.
All right. So ideas, you asked for ideas earlier, too,
sure.
About how we can all understand each other. And I love this dinner idea. What's a great idea? Interfaithconference.org.
It is a dinner. Launched and developed in Houston, Texas. It is a program that has spread to different parts of the country with something that we think could be of great value here for a variety of reasons, and we are looking at that. Among the many other things we do, we just had a big event at the Hindu Temple of Wisconsin and in Pewaukee in June, where we had over 140 people gathered to hear a Hindu speaker and to hear responses of people of different faiths to talk about religious interreligious dialogue, a friendship. And it was all based on the model of Gandhi and an Anglican priest who was his best friend, and how friendship can be the basis for much of what we're talking about.
Mm. Yes. Tom, thank you for all of your graciousness and intelligence on this. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tom Heinen, director of the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee. And he was mentioning Swaranji Arora, who will be our guest at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. So we'll learn more about the Sikh faith and how people can assist those who were directly affected by the horrors of the shootings. So we are going to continue. The press conference is going on, too, and we're letting you know what has happened at that press conference. Chuck Kornbach is there. U.S. Attorney James Santel, chief law enforcement officer in the district, says that Oak Creek is secure and there is no reason for the citizens of Oak Creek to worry about new attacks. In case you missed the earlier update, the officer who was shot is listed in critical condition, Lieutenant Brian Murphy. He's 51 years old. And they also said how old the victims were, a 41-year-old male, a 49-year-old male, 62-year-old male, 39-year-old male, 41-year-old female, and an 84-year-old male, who were all killed. And also two people who were wounded are in critical condition, but one has been treated and released. All right, we continue our conversation. The news reports have indicated that the shooter was Wade Michael Page, 40 years old, served in the Army for several years, and was assigned to psychological operations, or PSYOPs, according to the sources. This is information we've received from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel earlier this morning. He was no longer in the Army. The Southern Poverty Law Center, you know that group, they've been studying hate crimes for a long time, reported that he was a frustrated neo-Nazi who had been the leader of a racist white power band known as End Apathy. And he was the man who gunned down worshipers at the Sikh temple and shot and injured the Oak Creek police officer who was helping a victim before a second Oak Creek officer shot and killed Paige. Joining us now is Brian Levin. He is a professor of criminal justice, and he is director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University. He is author of Hate Crime, Understanding and Defining Hate Crime, and is joining us by phone. We'll also be welcoming phone calls for him. Professor Levin, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a very sad and unfortunately busy day as well.
Yeah, I'm sure it is, and it's an incredibly sad day. Tell me about whether or not there have been an increase in the number of hate groups in this country. Are we seeing a rise in them, or has it leveled off? Is it decreasing?
Great question. There has been a rise in the level of hate groups, and the data, while incomplete and limited, shows a decline in the number of hate crimes.
Hmm. And what about this particular group? I guess if this guy was a member, from what we know, of a band. It was a white power band. Do you know anything about End Apathy?
Yeah, there was an interview done on a web page back in 2005. This is part of a rather large and eclectic hate rock music scene, and this fellow has been a part of it. What I think is interesting also is that hate rock actually plays an interesting role. At Fort Bragg, in the 1990s, two neo-Nazi soldiers gunned down a black couple after getting drunk and listening to hate rock music.
Oh, my goodness.
And a lot of this hate rock music was purchased by a place called the National Alliance, which is now a hate group that's in relative disarray, but at one time was grossing over $1 million in revenue every year from the sale of materials, including hate rock.
Wow.
Yeah.
How do you hear this band? Are they on the Internet, or...?
Most of the stuff was done through direct mail. But this particular band, I think, was more, you'd be more likely to see them at some of these itinerant performances that take place.
Uh-huh. And who do they hate?
Oh, blacks, Jews, Muslims, immigrants, gays.
And it has been described as a neo-Nazi kind of party. Would you put it in that classification?
Yeah, I think that's accurate, yes.
And they hate all those groups because?
Well, it's part of the enabling belief system. And it appeals to young, frustrated white males who try to make sense of setbacks through scapegoating. But also, by the way, let me just say, it also validates them by becoming a member of a family, an in-group of these white warriors.
The information at the press conference is saying that Wade Michael Page, 40 years old, was in the military from 1992 to 1998. A general discharge was not eligible to re-enlist. It's hard to believe that somebody could be in the military that long and somebody would not have noticed that this guy had some very destructive beliefs.
Well, yeah, and around that time, the military revamped their policies with regard to hate group membership. The problem is that in the past, if you were an active member of a hate group, that could be a basis for institutional attention. However, today, you don't have to be a member of a group. You can be a fellow traveler and just go to shows or see sites on the Internet. So you don't have to have a baseball cap and an ID card, which makes it more difficult to police these folks. The shooters from Fort Bragg, by the way, which is also the place where this individual ended his career, actually have Nazi paraphernalia in their barracks.
Really? And nobody had noticed that?
Sure they noticed it.
And they didn't say, you're out of here?
Nope.
Why?
Well, there was an intensive investigation after that, and the military issued new rules and procedures.
Wow. The other thing that's terribly ironic here is that this guy was assigned to psychological operations, according to sources. Psychological operations.
They also say that he was a repairman too. So we'll find out. We'll find out more. I don't think he had a relatively significant role with respect to psychological operations. But we'll see. We're all getting the information as it comes in.
Do you see a significant difference when you look at the shooters, the shooter James Holmes in Aurora and this shooter in Oak Creek, Wisconsin? Is there something different, or are they all kind of hate crimes?
Well, great question. Great question. They have a lot of similarities and some differences. The main similarity is the fact that they are distressed, possibly depressed, socially and psychologically isolated people. However, this fellow combined his frustrations from personal setbacks with an enabling ideology, whereas with the Aurora shooter, it seems more of an idiosyncratic motive rather than a political one.
Uh-huh. And do you have to be really psychologically disturbed to do in both cases?
Well, you know, disturbed is one of those broad words.
Uh-huh.
Let me say this. Psychological distress. Most of these people are depressed, not insane. There are some that very well could be. We're going to see this week Jared Loughner, who I think there's a significant amount of evidence that he may not be legally competent, nevertheless pleading guilty. So it's very hard to get off by insanity. But what I would say is there's a spectrum of impairment, some of which is on the sociopathic side, which means someone knows what they're doing, but they are a person who doesn't care about the immorality of it, but they're aware of what they're doing, to people who have a cognitive impairment across the spectrum. I would say most of these people are depressed, frustrated, and have a festering anger which bubbles up, and this belief system labels who's an appropriate target for aggression.
Mm. I know that you watched all of this carefully yesterday from California. When you initially heard reports here, because you study this, must see this with different eyes than those of us who do not study this see events like this. What were your initial thoughts on this, and were you pretty much on the mark with them?
Well, let me say this. As someone, one thing I've learned is you always let the investigation take you where it goes, not the other way around. That being said, my first knee-jerk response, which sometimes is not correct, was like, this is a hate crime. Although, you know, a lot of mass killings involve someone who has a relationship in some way with the entity, too. So, for instance, school shooters will shoot up a school that they've attended, or they have a relationship with someone.
Right.
Many mass killers kill family members.
Mm.
So I didn't want to exclude that either. There could have been a congregant, for instance, who didn't get a promotion or something. But my first instinct was that this is a hate attack. But again, I never want to go with my first instinct, and that's why I wait 24 hours before I even write anything. But I did put something up in the Huffington Post today about these lone wolves, and unfortunately, they do occur routinely. Although, let me just say this. As a criminologist, you have a far greater risk of being killed by a drunk driver after attending an evening service somewhere than you do of being hurt in one of these attacks. Hate crimes are terrible, and we have thousands of them every year. But the hate homicides, at least according to the FBI, are relatively low, usually less than a dozen in any given year.
Hmm. And can you imagine why somebody would target people in a Sikh temple?
Yes. These folks are not like us. These folks are a bubbling well of anger and frustration, and they scapegoat against those who they perceive as being enemies or getting some unfair advantage. A person like this would regard Sikhs, and by the way, Latinos, Jews, it could be a panoply of folks, as folks who are antithetical to white America and the culture and system that white Americans founded. And when you experience a personal frustration and you're able to hook that in to a broader ideology, it makes you not a failure, but a warrior for a bigger cause. That's the twisted mind of this kind of person.
Yeah, it sure is. We'll take phone calls for you in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Professor Brian Levin is our guest. He's a professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, author of Hate Crime, Understanding and Defining Hate Crime. We're learning more this morning at the press conference in Oak Creek about this killer, Wade Michael Page, 40 years old. Was in the military from 1992 to 1998. He received a general discharge, was not eligible to reenlist. General discharge is not an honorable discharge. It's one step above a dishonorable discharge. From the press conference, Teresa Carlson with the FBI says that they still have an active crime scene. They are interviewing family and associates, but there is no reason to believe that anyone else is associated with the shooting. And the names of the victims will be posted on the Oak Creek City website this morning. To your calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, we will be speaking with a professor of economics at UWM and a Sikh representative to the Interfaith Conference who will join us from 9 to 10. Two phone calls now. Rose in Menominee Falls. Hi.
Hello. I'm calling to ask your guest if he is aware of there was an individual from, I believe, the staff of the Southern Poverty Law Center who headed a unit within the Justice Department. And I remember reading several months ago about how that unit was cut and he ended up resigning. And there were a bunch of politics involved, I think. And I'm wondering if you are aware of that. And at the time, I remember feeling outraged that the internal terrorism in our country was not treated the same way as, you know, globally. Are you aware of who that was?
He's not an employee of the Southern Poverty Law Center. There was a DHS analyst who came out with a report in 2009 on right-wing extremism, where he actually talked about veterans being targeted for recruitment. And it became a political hot potato, and that unit experienced some transformation. But I am pleased to tell you, having actually participated in DHS and other federal roundtables on this, the federal government is very much on the ball with regard to all kinds of extremism, including that which comes from the hateful side of the spectrum. Domestically. They're on top of it. I did a briefing just about one year ago today on it for the federal government. They're very much aware, and they have some dedicated folks who are constantly looking at trends with regard to this. One of the things that came up, by the way, at this conference where I spoke, and which I spoke of, I talked about active shooters and lone wolves. But active shooters and lone wolves are very difficult to detect prior to their rampages oftentimes.
The Oak Creek chief, again from the press conference, said the only information on the gun that they will release is that it was a 9mm handgun using multiple ammunition magazines. Do you want to comment on that, and how easy is it to get a gun like that, Professor Levin?
Well, it is easy to get a gun like that, but one thing I think is really interesting too, you know, contrasting this to the Aurora shooting, is that over the last 30 years, we routinely see, unfortunately, these kinds of incidents. Most of the time, though, these attacks involve handguns and not assault weapons. But handguns today have bigger magazines, mm-hmm. and are capable of inflicting a wider range of fatalities than in the past.
Patrick in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I want to first give incredible acknowledgement to the leaders of the Sikh member, you know, religion, how they are so forgiving.
Yes.
To the people that it causes. And so then I just want to jump into my lesser ability as such a great person. But what we're seeing is a great phrase, the chickens come home to roost. We're seeing people taking back our America. And this is a loose rhetoric that I think, you know, pushes, you know, people have been on the edge for the years, you know, and this is like some media and a part of a political party that's, I think, obvious not to have to mention, have pushed these people to do the dirty work for them. And I'm getting into the politics already, but we could analyze mentally ill and these hate groups, but it's really our culture promoting this. I mean, this isn't a shock anymore. I mean, I'm reading The Nation about, you know, another terrorist attack in America. Why are we surprised? You know, I wasn't, you know, but the value of life, I value life greatly. This is just a sad moment of America's race to the bottom of society.
Yeah, it is a sad moment. Professor Levin?
It is sad, but what I would say is I don't always like to connect these kind of attacks to debates that are going on in the political mainstream. And here's what I mean. This fellow belongs to an offshoot ideology that is not part of the mainstream. So he doesn't really care whether or not groups are getting labeled a certain way in the mainstream. He thinks the mainstream is illegitimate to begin with. So what I am saying is, while I think that those kinds of debates can oftentimes degrade and be damaging, in this instance, this is someone who's opted out of mainstream thinking. He doesn't care what mainstream politicians are saying. He belongs to an enabling ideology that says that people who are different not only shouldn't get benefits, but are legitimate targets for aggression. And I would really be very careful about lumping in conservatives willy-nilly with this particular fellow, because he belongs to an offshoot that regards conservative politicians as traitors and white traitors as well.
Again, from the press conference, Teresa Carlson with the FBI says that the suspect had contact with law enforcement in the past, but they will not say more about his record at the time. Classifying an attack as a domestic terrorist attack would automatically require a federal investigation. Kevin in Whitewater, hi.
Hello. My comments today are basically circled around the victims of this crime, whether it's a hate crime or terrorism, however they classify it after the fact. It's please do not forget the victims of the crime instead of exemplifying or glorifying through the media the person that committed the crime. And I guess glorifying would be a little bit of a push at that, but it seems that whenever something like this happens, the perpetrator is the one that everybody keeps talking about. And, you know, even though we don't know the names of the people that were killed or injured, we need to remember them and also remember that we live on one planet and we're here for a very short time in our own lives. And unfortunately, we do have people that are mentally unstable, and this type of thing does happen. And that's about it for my comments. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Professor Levin.
You know, it's unfortunate that these offshoot folks who represent really a splinter of American society can and indeed get the spotlight to give the impression that there are more haters than there are. Hate crimes are at near 14-year lows. The majority of Americans do not hold these types of views. But what I think is interesting is that there's a soft hatred that's going on in the United States, and that is that it's not so much these kind of headline-type attacks, which are terrible, but the more subtle yet insidious instances of discrimination and mistreatment which take place against certain groups on a more regular basis. And I think that impacts our national dialogue and relationships as well. These crimes are terrible, but things like bullying, things like discrimination in the workplace are far more pervasive. And I think this is, you know, the tip of an iceberg where we have a spectrum of prejudice which goes to from the routine, which affects many more people, to the extreme violent, which affects less, but still gets, and rightfully so, these significant headlines.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. We have a minute left. Pat in Richland Center. Hi.
Hey, good morning. Say, do either of you two remember back in the 90s, there was an attempt to blow up the World Trade Center that they did manage to, I think, run a van in the basement of it and have
right.
an explosion, killed a few people. Mm-hmm. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was February 1993.
Yeah, okay, good. Thank you. Hey, look, there was a guy, he was a cleric, blind guy, got a heck of a long prison sentence for being the group's spiritual leader. He had nothing to do with arranging the bombing or any of that sort of stuff, but he got a really terrific long federal sentence for being their spiritual leader. Now, you know where I'm going with this. I listen to Limbaugh almost every day, and you can get it 24/7, all that right-wing hate stuff. Take somebody unstable, fill them in with that kind of talk and stuff. So, of course, it's like if that guy can be convicted for being a spiritual leader, it doesn't work both ways, though, does it?
Professor Levin.
A couple quick things. First of all, they weren't Sikhs, number one. Abdel Rahman was actually part of a conspiracy, so he actually committed a crime. And I also just got an investigative reporting award for reporting on radical Muslim extremists. And they are a sliver of the Muslim American community. What I think is important here is that irrespective of the ideology, we do have a threat domestically from lone wolves whose personal frustrations and social isolation make them a risk to society. Some of them might adhere to a right-wing, hateful ideology. When I say right-wing, I don't mean...
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. I'm sorry, we are out of time. Professor Brian Levin, our guest this hour. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rob Ferret for producing this hour. Tomorrow, we will speak with a Sikh representative to the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee. That conversation at 9 o'clock. Thanks for being a part of this one.